right, folks, welcome back to another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches. I'll be honest, I've lost track of what number we're on. I think this is five, maybe six, but not necessarily releasing them all in the same order we record them anyway. So this is the current episode of Mentioned in Dispatches. And tonight we have with us two returning voices. We have OJ's dad, the other Mike. Howdy, Mike. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good tonight.
All righty. And then we've also got back for a third engagement, the guy who may end up becoming the semi-irregular occasional co-host around here. Ian, our good buddy from the Rocky Mountain Navy, is back. How are you doing?
Hey, good evening. Everyone's doing good.
Hey, I've got enough rain falling here that I may need a Navy guy to come bail us out at some point.
Well, I got to get through the rain here to get to you.
Yeah. Pairs of animals were spotted walking around my backyard earlier this afternoon. It's in search of an ark. There's a lot of, for not being a hurricane or the remnants of one coming through here, we got a lot of rain showing up tonight. You know, not that the audience cares, right? Because they're listening to this 10 days later and going, who cares when it was raining? Something that I found rather interesting, I was going back listening to some older episodes of Mentioned in Dispatches, just cycling through, kind of making sure we weren't repeating some content or that we were keeping things a little fresh. One of the things I noticed, apparently last season, just about every episode I introduced as, we've got a special episode tonight. Tonight we've got a special, here's a special episode of, every episode was a special episode. So this season, the goal is to do nothing but ordinary episodes of Mentioned in Dispatches. So welcome guys to an ordinary episode of Mentioned in Dispatches. Appreciate y'all being here.
Feels so special.
There you go. Tonight, we're going to ordinarily discuss, again, looking at topics, we've covered Cold War quite a bit from a couple of different angles. We've talked a bunch about Napoleonic Wars, Age of Gunpowder, because we've got a whole bunch of the Square Button Brigade floating around with the Dragoons. And, you know, look, they lent a name to our site, right? The Armchair Dragoons just drip with Napoleonic references there. But something we haven't covered a ton of was World War One, and we haven't done a whole lot of talking about that over the years. And Mike, I know that's a bit of a passion of yours. Look, you're the guy with the complete set of Der Weltkrieg. Not only that, but you're busy converting them all for use on Tabletop Simulator. Ian, you know, you've got all sorts of different war games there that cover a variety of those eras. Brought you guys in to talk a little World War One. So Mike, let's start with you. What is it about World War One that you find compelling and interesting from a wargaming perspective?
First of all, it's not World War II. And it's not the American Civil War. I don't know. Just I think it just, you know, those two, along with Napoleonic and the Napoleon era, you know, just get hammered so much that, first of all, I wanted something that I didn't know as much about, maybe doesn't get as much press. I think it's just an interesting time. I think it's, you know, if you look at what Germany and Austria started off with and how they were fighting literally a two-front war from day one and it went and got progressively worse from there, and yet they managed to hold on for, what was it, 4 years? You know, and it's at that cusp of warfare too. You know, it wasn't mechanized, it wasn't real mobile, but yet you had the railroads in there. You had the age of aircraft coming in, birth of more modern weapons. So, I don't know. It just, like I said, it's just an interesting time period.
Yeah, yeah. There are some that argue that World War One is the first industrial war. I've heard the case. I don't want to trivialize it. It's certainly a compelling case. There are places where you can argue with it, but it's a good case to be made for that. Ian, what about you? What about World War One do you find particularly fascinating or interesting? I'll let you guys chime in here before I throw
in
my two cents.
So, Mike's covering the ground side. From the Navy side, I think really it comes down to the big battles. You've got the Battle of Jutland. You've got those huge battle lines, the ultimate, instead of the sailing ships doing broadsides, now you've got those armored behemoths out there that are throwing shells over the horizon at somebody else. And just the awe, even just seeing it in the miniatures or looking at a battle line laid out on a map and sitting there rolling your 16-inch guns as they go blasting a Volkswagen-sized shell across the board, figuratively. That piece there is just so awesome. And in many ways, the Navy side, I think, is also appealing because you get the big guns, you get the big ships, but you also, you don't really have the submarines and you don't have the air. So in many ways, it's a very clean game. It's just the ship on ship, battle line on battle line type piece. And a lot of people can just really get into that. One, from an imagination side of it, of, you know, this is the battle going on. And two, from a rules perspective, is like, because it's not complicated with all those extra air and missiles and all that other stuff coming in. On the air side, it really is. There's romanticism about it still, that the Knights of the Air, the planes themselves aren't sitting there, you know, going this super fast, zipping across the board, blasting somebody, you know, beyond visual range, that sort of stuff. It really is. You can really get a game where you get that little feel of that, you know, chivalrous combat, so to speak. And you can, your planes aren't sitting there and you're not, getting lost in the rules again. It is somewhat simple. And it's also, in this case, something like Wings of Glory, where you have nice, bright, colorful miniatures. Looks dang good on the table too. So for those reasons, I mean, it's a simpler set, simpler time to play, but still has a lot of romanticism about it and a lot of feed to your imagination that can really make it fun.
Yeah, I think that Knights of the Air aspect certainly comes into play in that. I don't know the history near as well as probably anybody else listening to this right now, but you didn't have mass formations of aircraft flying around in World War One in these big lockstep patterns, trying to, you know, overwhelm folks with mass, where you were just another cog in the machine. Like at the time, those guys flying those individual planes were, I mean, those guys were kind of cool. Those, you know, Snoopy the Flying Ace and all, but I mean, those, they were unique, singular individuals out there in a lot of one-on-one combat, or maybe you'd bring two or three of your buddies with you, but it was dogfighting. I mean, in its most pure sense, it was not, you know, large escorts of heavy bombers. It was not interceptors trying to take out large formations of heavy bombers. It was a lot of kind of mano a mano sort of aircraft stuff. But I mean, I don't even recall a lot of close air support or really, aside from some spotting and reconnaissance missions, how often did you have aircraft affecting the ground fight in World War One the way you did in World War? Look, I mean, it's an underrated part of the U.S. march across France, but the U.S. got really good at close air support once they got off the beach in Normandy, to where, I mean, you had B-25s coming in at 200 feet, dropping bombs on things that were 300 feet in front of the U.S. forces. They got really good at close air support in World War II, but I don't ever recall seeing anything about that in World War One. Was it a factor at all, Ian?
So not necessarily close air support, but I think the idea of the artillery spotting, if you dig into the actual, so there's a whole mythology that's built up around World War One, and a lot of the mythology about the air is these knights of the air and these dogfighting. The more the truth of the matter is, there was dogfighting going on, but a lot of that dogfighting was going on for a reason. And many times the reason was the artillery spotter planes. So the one side would send out their artillery spotters, the other side would send out their artillery spotters, and both sides would send out fighters to shoot down those artillery spotting airplanes. Well, then you had to defend your artillery spotters. So you put up your fighter patrol to take on their fighter patrol. So you ended up with these dogfights. They were out there shooting each other down, but the real reason behind it is because they were trying to keep those guys from getting to those barrage balloons, or the artillery spotting balloons, or to get to those low, slow planes that were out there doing that artillery spotting piece. I mean, there was a lot of the groundwork for close air support was laid through the artillery spotting. The idea of having like the panels so that the artillery folks on the ground could communicate to the airplane. The airplane had blinker lights, or even at the later part of the war, started doing radios. RT systems to talk directly to their artillery down below, or to at least talk to like an artillery control center of some sort. So a lot of the early pieces of World War II close air support, the groundwork was laid in World War One. There's a great book out there, Bloody April, which talks about Arras in, 1916, I think. And that whole piece where the Bloody April, where the Brits lost so many planes. Well, the planes they were losing weren't necessarily the fighters. They were losing their artillery spotting planes. and the Germans were coming out trying to shoot him down, and the British kept trying to put him up and figure out how to protect him. And that was a big part of sort of a hidden piece of the war. This GMT made a game on it, Bloody April. Surprise, surprise. Very interesting game, because winning and losing is not determined really by how good a dogfighter you are. It's determined by how well you protect your artillery spotters and can they complete their missions without getting interfered with, which is really the truth of what was happening in World War One.
That sounds a lot like sort of keeping the focus on where the fight belongs, not unlike what you had mentioned with Blue Water Navy, right? I mean, there's a big fight going on out in the ocean during the Cold War, but ultimately it's in support of a ground war somewhere. And so
exactly.
All this dogfighting out there is happening not for its own sake, but, you know, like you said, to protect whatever assets there were. Mike, looking back at some of the ground combat pieces that you talked about, I'm right there with you in terms of it's not World War II. It's not the Napoleonics or the American Civil War, right? It's not Stalingrad, the Bulge, Waterloo, Austerlitz, you know, Gettysburg and Vicksburg, right? It's we get out of those top dozen or so topics and let's go do something different. Der Weltkrieg is one of the big animals that you've got there, but what other land combat games have you monkeyed around with, if many? And what is it, you know, again, it's not, you know, it is something different, but are there particular things that you found in playing some of these or studying some of these that you kind of had a bit of an aha moment or sort of scratched your head and went, hey, that's interesting. I don't know that I realized that before.
Sure. I don't have a whole lot of other games on the subject. I do have Gallipoli 1915, which I have not had a chance to play yet. I just got it recently. From GMT Games, I have 1918-1919 on pre-order. It's supposed to ship here in October. And this is a hypothetical. What happens if the war extended into 1919? So I'm looking forward to getting that here in about a month.
Interesting you mentioned the war extending into 1919. When we were doing our happy hour, you know, a couple weeks ago, one of the books I pulled off my shelf was Black Jack Pershing's History of the American Expeditionary Force in France. And the official U.S. military history of this, I say it's the official, it's the one written by Pershing. I don't know if that was ever blessed by the Center for Military History or not, so probably shouldn't call it the official history. But that one dates the war into 1919. You know, everybody sort of looks at the 11th of November and says, all right, that's when it all ended. But, you know, even Pershing drags that into 1919. And look, I haven't read the book cover to cover, so I don't know the full story as to why he extends it all into 1919. But at least at the time, because that book was published in the early 1920s, at the time, contemporary accounts of World War One dragged that date, you know, beyond the ceasefire. And it may have been simply that Pershing was talking about when all the American Expeditionary Forces finally got home off the boat into 1919. But at the time, they looked at it as beyond just the 11th of November, 1918. So I don't know how hypothetical that necessarily might be. I mean, it did. There may have been more than we realize.
And I think you have to stop to realize, right, the Allies didn't necessarily have a military victory. What they had was the German population said, enough's enough. We're hungry. We're tired. Uh-huh. We're done. You know, it really came down to food.
Yeah. Yep.
I actually stumbled across a book not too long ago, written by a gentleman named Avner Offer. And it's titled The First World War, an Agrarian Interpretation Summary. And basically he's taken World War One and he's looking at it from a food point of view. You know, that in the late 19th century, England had changed its laws with food and started importing a lot more. Well, she built up her navy to make sure she could protect her food supplies. Germany also had the same problems with food, but wasn't able to take the steps to ensure her food supply.
And yeah.
Eventually it got to her. You know, that's why when you start looking at things like in late 1914, early 1915, when you had Hindenburg and Ludendorff trying to convince Falkenhayn to go after Russia, you know, knock them out. They're weak. They're not able to stand. If they would have done that in 1915, 1916 and could have secured more food supplies out of Ukraine and Belarus, who knows what could have happened. Instead, you got Verdun.
Yeah. Well, and on the political front, Again, World War One is not particularly my era that I know a ton about, but I do know a little bit. And one of the things that had always fascinated me was how much the fallout from World War One directly led to all of the problems that became World War Two. And for the three of us on the call and most of our listeners, that's one of those sort of no shit kind of statements, right? I mean, we all get that actions have consequences, and we understand the threads that you can sort of weave through history there. But I think for a lot of the general population, first of all, they probably have no idea who actually fought who in World War One. They probably think we were fighting the Nazis just because they were Germans on the other side. But one of the big fallouts, you mentioned that it was the German population that sort of said, all right, enough is enough. The German army surrendered on French soil. It's not like we were marching into Berlin or something, the way the Russians took down Berlin in 45. Germany had not been breached. And this was after the Russians surrendered and they were busy shuttling everybody from east to west to reinforce that Western front. And so the fact that the German army kind of felt stabbed in the back, like, I get it. I don't want to say that like I sympathize with them, but I could understand why they would be as pissed as they were, given that they felt like the politicians betrayed them and they weren't beaten in the field. That's a tough way to sign a surrender document, right? I mean, the army's intact. They're holding serve. You're on the enemy's territory. Like, you're on French soil when the politicians wave the white flag. Yeah, you'd be pissed.
Well, and the German army still had a lot of troops in the east, right? Mm-hmm. Because they were afraid of the Bolsheviks still.
Yeah, everybody was.
And you know, and right there's one of those things post-World War One, right? You know, was I don't think a lot of people realize how much the Soviet Union was invading. They were literally on the steps of Warsaw in, what, 1920?
Yeah.
1920,
was it 20 or 21?
20.
I think it was 1920.
Yeah. I mean, I forget who it was, but one of the French generals showed up and the Poles are looking at him saying, great, how many divisions did you bring? Just me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't think people realize that Lenin was pushing hard west. His intent was to get into Germany.
Well, yeah, the Bolsheviks had everybody scared enough that there was an Allied expeditionary force that invaded Russia, yeah, up in the north. And like, again, we talked about this a little bit on the happy hour. There's probably 98% of the U.S. population that doesn't know that the U.S. invaded Russia in 1918. They don't know that that happened, but they did. Like, there was a Anglo-American invasion force that landed, you know, was it Murmansk or Arkhangelsk that they invaded?
Murmansk.
Okay. Yeah.
Was it both?
It was up that peninsula. Yeah. So
yeah, sure. We can go with both. Again, there's like two people listening to this that will actually have the knowledge to contradict us. So we can probably make some of this up as we go. But don't worry, Tolstoy will fact check us in the forums. He'll sort all this out, you know, within like 2 days of this podcast going. I love the dude, man. His companion posts to the podcast are awesome because he's doing my homework for me. It's great.
Actually, yeah, Siberia, the other side of the coast.
Okay.
Vladivostok. And then, yeah, I'm looking at this here, the Czech Legion. Also had the Czech Legion came out and was controlling the Trans-Siberian railroads over there.
There was a U.S. and Anglo-American invasion force on the over on the European side that went in around Scandinavia and came in the north from up there.
Landed at Arkhangelsk and in Vladivostok.
Okay. So, yeah, it, you know, again, you're talking about being afraid of the Bolsheviks. Everybody was. So that's completely understandable. Right. But again, I think, you know, it's an imperfect peace. You know, it's the German army is rightfully pissed off at the end of all this. I think the Austrians were probably, you know, especially the Habsburgs were pissed, but there's not much they could do about it. You know, they'd had this patchwork quilt of an empire they'd managed to hold together somehow for the better part of like 500 years. It's a miracle it lasted that long.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned like the end of the war, because in my experience with World War One war gaming, it's actually the other side of the battle or other side of the conflict, the beginning of the war, that seems to get a lot more of the attention. I mean, I was sitting down here going like, what was the big, okay, you always got Battle of the Bulge, you got Battle of Midway, and you got Battle of Kursk or your big World War II battles. What's your big World War I battle that you see? And I kept coming, the only one I could really come up with that people, maybe it's just me, but the Battle of the Marne at the other side of the war, before all the trenches came in, before everyone started digging in, when there still was mobility and there still was maybe a chance for victory. Those are the ones that I see a lot more World War I games about, and a lot more interesting because in many ways it's not World War I.
Yeah.
At least how we mythicize, romanticize it. And it's all the trenches. It's just, go back and forth.
Yeah. You get the Marne for sure. You occasionally get some of the late war battles when the tanks show up just because you got tanks showing up. And then you get Verdun because it was the big casualty factory. But there's just nothing to Verdun, right? I mean, at that point, it's the equivalent of an 1880s boxing match. It's two guys standing on a line, punching each other until one of them falls off the line, and they could go 112 rounds, and nobody's going to move. They both have permanent brain damage, and nobody's going to move. Verdun is probably one of the least interesting battles in wargaming, period. All you're doing is just sort of sitting still, lobbing rounds at each other and seeing who can roll higher on the dice for more casualties. There's so little to that battle from a wargaming perspective.
If I remember correctly, it was never meant to be a big breakout battle, right? It was really meant to be a battle of attrition.
Oh, absolutely. The Germans even said.
Yeah, his whole strategy was to bleed the French army, and all he did was end up bleeding himself. I think that's where, you had people like Hindenburg and
Ludendorff.
So pissed just because, they're looking at this saying, we could have used those troops and smashed our way through Russia. But at the same time, you had a lot of German officers that were afraid of Russia still. They were afraid that if you pushed Russia too hard, that the masses would rise up. And that was a big concern on their part.
They kind of did that anyway.
What's that?
They kind of did that anyway.
Yeah, Russia had a lot of internal problems.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, their railroad system was a mess. They had people cramming into the cities and they couldn't get food enough to them.
It would be a much shorter list of things if you just listed the things that weren't a mess in Russia in 1915.
Yeah. but we say that, but at the same time, why did Germany jump at a chance to go to war with Russia at that time? Because she knew that Russia was slowly getting her act together economically and socially. And that's what Germany feared. So people will say, well, Germany just went and declared war on them. Well, but because they were scared crapless. You had the French on one side and you had the Russians on the other side of you. And Germany just felt, now's the time. We've got to do it now. This is our last chance. Last opportunity.
Yeah, I am, not only do I have a great war game store in my backyard here in town, I've also got a great military history professor right here in my backyard. There's a guy that teaches at, I think he's officially on the faculty at UNC, but teaches at both Duke and NC State also. And look, when all three of them are in commuting distance, it's very easy to teach at all three. The guy's name is Joe Cadell, and he's a now retired Air Force reservist. He taught the military history class that I had to take as a part of my ROTC program. And the guy was so engaging, I ended up taking other classes just as free electives from him because I love taking classes with him. He was that good of... The guy taught history the right way. He told good stories, and he was a good storyteller to tell those stories. One of these days when we're all sitting around a beer, ask me about the time Richard Nixon almost ran him over. It's a great story. One of the things that he always talked about with World War I was, and again, this goes back to your point, Ian, sort of the start of the war. How did all these things, sort of ramp up? The European countries had figured out how to do mobilization on a mass scale. And so that meant not just calling up the units, but being able to synchronize the trains to move those units, being able to synchronize what tools they had available logistically to support those mass assemblages of units. But if you did that, once you flipped the switch, on the entire system. There was no way to only mobilize part of it. And so one of Cadell's arguments was always that sort of blundering into World War I, when the Serbs and the Austrians started their little pissing contest, look, we, we've all seen the meme online about, you know, what if World War One was a bar fight where, you know, Germany looks at Serbia, rolls up its sleeves and then punches Belgium. We've seen those sort of goofy little memes that show up. But one of the concerns, going back to what you were talking about, Mike, is being concerned about the Russians. When the Austrians and Serbians were having their little pissing contest and the Russians were looking at themselves as the protectors of the Eastern Europeans, the protectors of the Slavs, and were wanting to sort of help out the Serbs, you know, their buddies there, they decided to mobilize some of their forces to kind of make the Austrians think twice about this. The problem is you couldn't just mobilize the Southern Front or whatever you want to call that part of the Russian front. So when the Tsar starts mobilizing, he's got to like mobilize everybody. Otherwise the train schedules are all going to get messed up and the logistics stuff's not going to show up where it needs to be. And so he flips on the mobilization switch and suddenly 15 million dudes show up at train stations to catch a ride somewhere. And a non-trivial percentage of them are along the German frontier. And so, yeah, the Germans are nervous. What the hell are all these guys going to do? And even if the Russians had no intention of ever touching the Germans, you still get nervous when there's that many armed Russians on your border. Even today, you would do well to be nervous with that many armed Russians on your border. And so, you know, part of Cadell's thesis and all of that is that the system itself was built to help enable that level of catastrophe, simply because there was no way to do it in any incremental fashion, that it was either all or nothing. You know, those amps went to 11, but they never went to 5. So, hey, Ian, what are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, that's pretty much the classic teaching from joint planning. The joint planning schools is that they had a plan. If you look coming back into the 1870s and the development of the German general staff and everybody adapting the staff system, everybody had a plan. And everybody had the plan. It was on the shelf. It was all timed out. They knew exactly, you know, what trains they were going to need to have where and what units was going to go where and who's they're going to marry up. The problem was they had a plan. They didn't have branches and sequels, and they didn't have we're only going to do one part of this or the other part. So when things started going sideways and the leadership, the national leadership says, okay, you know, military guys, do your military thing. Well, they only knew one thing to do. And that's where a lot of the common, you know, says, hey, the war became a railroad at that point. You know, there was no way of getting around it. And that presents an interesting challenge for game designers because, even something like Paths of Glory starts with mobilization. You've already started with the plan in place and you're looking at it going, am I going to do the same thing? Am I going to go east? If you're Germany, are you going to go east or west first? And which way are you going to go? And in some ways, the plan's already preset for you and you're just trying to get along and saying, can I execute it better than they did? Which sometimes I think is why World War One is sometimes not as interesting, because sometimes it feels like it is railroading you. Maybe designers are getting better at creating some of that freedom these days, but for the longest time, I mean, go back and look like Avalon Hill's Guns of August. I mean, it really just starts at August and you're going to end up in trenches and you're going to be in a attritional slugfest. There's no other way around it, because that's the way they made the game to reflect the war.
It became more of a simulation than a game.
Yeah. Do you really want to scratch that itch, Mike?
No, but I'm just saying, though, that
I know.
You know, I mean, if you look at the Der Weltkrieg, right? Everything's built around what really happened. There's no what-if scenarios or anything like that. So, you know, it doesn't lead credence to saying, hey, by the way, if Verdun doesn't happen, you can take X number of divisions from West Front and ship them east type deal. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I totally get it. What I was about to say, so that brings up a really interesting design question. Putting on a bit of the design hat here, and again, my knowledge of the World War One wargaming world is not as expansive as pretty much anybody. Like, my son probably knows as much about World War One wargaming as I do, and he's addicted to his Xbox. So, but from a wargaming perspective, one of the things that I've always thought was really kind of cool, and I actually have a copy of it now, is so GMT has put together these, and there's now one for both the Pacific and European theaters of conflict for World War II, but they've got the games that you play before the World War II game starts. And so you sort of pick up in the 30s, and what does the mobilization and ramp up to the war look like? Where do you put your industrial base? Where do you put your training? What kinds of diplomatic efforts are you making? What are the things you're doing with the possibility of war on the horizon? How are you prepping for getting to the war? And we see that in a variety of World War II games where people are playing with the conditions that get you to September of 39 and everything sort of kicks off. It's actually easier to do in the Pacific, obviously, because the Japanese invade China way before that. But you're changing the conditions on the ground leading up to September 39. Do the Germans still seize half of Czechoslovakia? Do they reoccupy the Rhineland? What happens with the Spanish Civil War? Do the Turks stay neutral? Like all of these different what ifs you get the opportunity to play with before World War II sort of kicks off. I don't know of any, and I haven't seen any comparable game for World War I, but I almost wonder if that wouldn't make for a more interesting challenge, maybe even a slightly more dynamic challenge, particularly on the political front with the kinds of alliances that were contrary to what history had been up to that point. I mean, that was the first time we really had a major Anglo-French alliance that actually mattered, right? That actually, you know, the Brits and French had spent 1,200 years at each other's throats leading up to World War I. If we tweak the start conditions of World War I, it almost makes for a far more interesting war than trying to tweak the start conditions for World War II, wouldn't you think? Mike, based on what you've played with Der Weltkrieg, what would you think, you know, sort of backing up and starting the game in 1910? Like, what does that do to you?
It presents some options. I personally don't have a problem with starting the game in 1914 that way. It's really when you get to the end of 1914 that a lot of decisions could have been made, I think, that could have really changed the outcome of the war. People will look at it and say, well, why did Germany invade France in 14 first? Well, look what they did to France just, 40 years earlier in 1870.
Yeah.
They ran right over the French army. So there was some logical thinking there that, hey, we can do this again. And frankly, they came within a whisker of doing it. What was it, 6 British divisions that basically put a stop to it?
And a whole lot of taxi drivers.
Yeah. But at the same time, though, I don't know that the Germans were always pushing the French as hard as they could along the original French-German border.
Yeah.
So for me, it's not so much always going back real far. It's just give me some other opportunities. Show me how some things could be different in 1915, so to speak.
Yeah.
Obviously, you always want to have that chance of what if we would have gone, or what if the Germans would have played the defense right from the get-go and not invaded Belgium, you know. And of course, people sit there and say, well, England would probably still have jumped into the war. Okay, that's fine. Would have made much difference except for blockading Germany at that point.
Yeah, I don't know. Fair question. Ian, what do you think? Change the start conditions or just give people more options once it actually starts?
I think the game you're talking about is Cataclysm, a Second World War, because that game tries not to recreate the Second World War, but like you said, creates its own story of how you could get to a Second World War. I'd love to see a World War I version of that, but I just don't know.
Yeah. Cataclysm is one of them. The other one that I'm thinking of is Gathering Storm. I was looking it up while Mike was talking. Gathering Storm is the ETO one. There's a comparable PTO one, but I don't remember what it is off the top of my head. I have Gathering Storm.
So talk about what, you know, game design and changing the conditions. I think maybe in the political, geopolitical games and the land warfare games, the changing the conditions would make a difference. I think when you talk about changing conditions and doing something different now, especially for naval games, now is when I go to the end of the war, because that's when all the nice, good toys are coming out. And the 1920s, if you don't have the naval arms treaties, and you get those giant battleships and those giant battle cruisers and those big, huge pieces out there. If you get the Lexington and the Saratoga, not as the aircraft carriers, but as battle cruisers cruising out there. Now, naval gamers, now you're giving me a really fun game, because now I can sit there and really start blasting things across the water and really have a lot of fun. Same thing with the air. Finally, at the end of the war, I'm getting aircraft that don't, you know, claw for altitude and take forever to reach 500 feet. I'm getting some stuff with a little bit of some pep that I can go out there. And now I'm going to have to take all those aces of World War One and take all the lessons that they taught me. And now I'll be able to go out and start doing some real work. Still with challenges because there wasn't the radio. You don't get in that stuff into World War II. So it's a really a super World War One. At the end, some of those fantasy pieces are a lot more appealing. You don't get to that by changing the beginning. So maybe in the geopolitical or land side, yeah, play around with changing it. But from a Navy and air perspective, I do pretty well during the war. And then it's after the war that really gets interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. The Washington Naval Treaty is the one after World War One, but before World War One, what sorts of naval treaties were we talking about then? Was there much? I don't know off the top of my head. That's just a blind spot for me.
So before World War One, when you talk about like the industrial war, there was so many rapid developments. The development of the dreadnought, the all big gun ships. You look at there's a wonderful book out there somewhere in Naval Institute Press years ago on the French designs. The French, like every 2 years, were coming up with a new design of a battleship, a new concept, all through the 1870s, 80s, 90s. It wasn't until the Russo-Japanese War that things sort of started settling down. But then everybody went with the big guns. But it was all a matter of budget. Who's going to build how many ships? Are you building an 8-8 Navy, 8 battleships, 8 cruisers? Are you going to build... How are you taking you already have battleships, the older class battleships, the mixed gun battleships on the slipways? Do you just take them, scrap those in place and go with the all big gun, or do you have some sort of a plan to transition? The U.S., Britain gets all credit for the dreadnought and stuff, but the U.S. had big gun battleships on the slipways at the same time. So, I mean, the writing was on the wall there. The real hard part is how are you going to use them? And there was actually some technology that hadn't caught up yet. One thing in naval wargaming, I think that a lot of people or a lot of game designs miss is the whole development of fire control systems. And yeah, that gets more into a simulation, Mike, than it does into a game. But if that's your thing, the impact of fire control systems, when some folks had the newer, some fire control tables and other ones didn't have anything but still the spotters on a turret top, makes for an interesting naval game, mixing all those technologies together, especially if you're mixing them even on the same side.
You bring up the what was the naval, the shipbuilding planning. Let's face it, in terms of developing long-term plans, the Navy guys have a much greater need for it than the Army guys, given how complex and extensive those ship builds can be and how far out they've got to start to get anywhere. It does bring back some of the conversation we'd had a couple weeks ago when we were talking about the World War II Pacific Theater and sort of what might change based on changing some conditions between Europe or the Pacific. And one of the points you brought up is we're still building the same ships, right? Those keels went down in 37, and so they're still going to get built no matter what happens, Pearl Harbor or not, go to Europe first or go to the Pacific first. Like, those boats were still coming out of dry dock either way. And so building those ships leading up to World War One, I mean, I guess that was going to happen either way, wasn't it?
Yeah, the ships are going to be there. The real question became, how are you going to use them? And that, of course, comes down to the whole, is Germany going to come out and fight? Are they going to be the fleet in being? Germany taking an asymmetric approach with their U-boats. And then how did the British respond to that? Not ASW. Well, not really ASW, mine warfare, the barrages. So, there was a lot of... It's too much to say it was on the fly thinking, but there was certainly a give and take response that happened there. Same thing happened in the air. You had at the beginning of the war, you had really just some folks with ideas that, hey, we'll have these airplanes and they'll do something. And that grew into an entire system, the Royal Flying Corps, that was pushing hard to do artillery spotting and really advancing the technology of the day. Always trying to come up with something new, and folks developing the technology with the eye towards, hey, we have a mission. How do we build an airplane to do this? The first artillery spotter planes, and even later into the war, 1916, 1917, the FE-2 for the British, a great spotting airplane because it's slow, it's stable, but it's slow and not very maneuverable, and you got to somehow protect it.
Yeah.
Bullet magnet, yes.
We're talking about designers kind of maybe sometimes trying to lock you into things also. David Schroeder with his Der Weltkrieg games, if you look at the Italian front, he gives some explanations as to why he's put restrictions on the Italian army. And it's basically, here's a theory of how they fought wars going when they came into the war. And it took a lot of time for them, for the senior officers to realize, yeah, this isn't working. And it wasn't really time. It was blood, right? Bad experiences. And so I don't have too much of a problem if a game designer says, historically, this is why we're kind of putting you these shackles on you on this game design. That's fine, you know, but just explain it to your audience as to why this is the way it is. Don't just say, oh, this is the rule and there you go.
Yeah.
I think that's why some of those early battles like the Marne and stuff really do end up being more popular, because there isn't as many shackles. It's like maybe the limits are in your reinforcements, or the limits are in the mobility across the battlefield. But other than that, it really is sort of a wide open conflict. And you know, face it, gamers don't like sitting there. If they're going to have a stack of counters, they love watching them move across the map. When they're all just sitting in a pile and stack, and you're just rolling Yahtzee rolls of dice every turn, and then some of them are going away. There's no fun in that.
Yeah, that gets old in a hurry.
You're right. Give them a game where it's a more wide open. Hey, I can do that giant right hook. I can do that big swing. I can pull those taxis out and try to get them to the battlefield to help me get the guys there fast enough. Oops, no, the taxi drivers are on strike today. It is France. So, yeah. You know, maybe everything goes differently.
Mike, going back to your opening point of sort of what's attractive about World War One is it's not World War Two. I think so many of us know so much about World War Two that it's very easy to point to those inflection points along the way and say, well, if you do something different here, we've got these huge ripple effects somewhere else. And I just wonder how well we all know World War One to necessarily know where those inflection points might be, that if you do this one thing differently, you get these dramatically different outcomes somewhere else. But then you've got guys like your designer for Der Weltkrieg that specify, here's why I'm not going to let you color outside the lines based on whatever reason, right? The particular political nature of the people in charge, or there were legitimate terrain limitations or equipment limitations or whatever it may have been. By the time people are hearing this podcast episode, it'll be several weeks ago. But last week on the Design by Dragoons column that we publish every Monday, we ask a variety of designers, you know, hey, here's a question about game design or gameplay and execution. And we've got a panel of folks that we let them chime in. Hey, here's a couple of thoughts. And one of the ones that we asked was how much, if at all, should the game design enforce any particular kind of doctrinal requirements? Should you put particular limitations on the players based on what was known of the way those forces operated at the time, how they did things, what they did? And there are two schools of thought there. One school of thought is, no, let the players explore whatever they want. That's the point of the war game, right? Don't put the straitjackets on them. What could have happened? And so I totally get that. I think there's definite room for those kinds of explorations. On the other hand, I think there are certain things that get doctrinally enforced the wrong way sometimes and lead to inaccurate ways in which you end up playing in the sandbox. And I'm going to go outside of World War One for the example here, going to a more modern game. The Modern Battles Quad game from the late 70s of Würzburg is one of the best examples. But there are others out there. Not enforcing particular doctrinal ways in which units fight lead to bad effects within the game on the battlefield, in that the Würzburg game is a battalion level game. So all of the counters running around out there are battalions doing their thing within the U.S. Army division structure. And so it's 3rd Infantry Division of Würzburg in the 70s. So, you know, there's your tie into the Rock of the Marne. It's the 3rd Infantry Division out there. They've got all their tank battalions, their infantry battalions running around out there. But they also, what ends up happening is the divisional cav squadron gets consolidated into a single battalion level counter. Well, with no real cav mission as a part of what they're doing on the map, consolidating that whole cav squadron into a single counter, like, I got it, that's just what you end up with in the counter mix, when in reality, all those individual cav troops, those company level units, would have been scattered across the front of the division doing that screening mission out in front of the division. And by consolidating them into a single counter, first of all, you're not giving them the amount of real estate that they should be taking up out there. But what you've done is, by aggregating all of the forces in that counter, you've shoved way more firepower into a single cav squadron counter than should be in one place consolidated on the battlefield. So you end up with essentially a heavily armed fire brigade that plugs a lot of holes in the line for the actual line units. That's not what they should be doing. Contrast that with the way the 5th Corps series in the magazines employs the cav units. Where all of the other counters in the game are battalions, the cav units are broken down into individual troops. Now, they're woefully underpowered. That's by design. But they're split out there in an appropriate doctrinal usage, so you don't just have this heavily armed fire brigade that can plug holes in your line. So this is an example of where, does the designer enforce doctrine? Does the designer not enforce doctrine? And I know that's a digression off of World War I where we were talking, but taking that back to World War I, how much do you enforce doctrine, not enforce doctrine? Does digging in to the trenches, because that's what they historically did, is that being done because that's just what both sides started doing? Is that being done for survivability? And that just makes the most sense. Hey, we're going to dig in because we're trying not to get all our guys killed to where mom back home insists that we surrender. Are we digging in because that's the most effective way to win the war? Why are we digging in? Why trench warfare in this fashion? And do we give people the option of not digging in? And yeah, it means you're taking higher casualties charging into machine gun barrages, but is that a better way to break the enemy's trench line rather than just dig into your own trench line? There's a lot of doctrinal questions there to kind of ask, and how much do you want to let people play with that?
Well, I guess what's interesting is another rule that David has in all of his Darvell Craig games is stated quite simply, we gave you an army, we expect you to use it, and that's in quotes. And so the rule for all of his games is you can only build up so many supply points. And if you exceed those supply points, you lose the game. And his comments are, and from my reading of the of commanders and doctrines at the time, everybody was offensive minded. So everybody was going on the offense. So those trenches on the Western Front really didn't develop on the Eastern Front to the same degree. The ones on the Western Front were, I think, weren't really doctrine. It was just more spur of the moment of what happened. And then you had both sides just kind of throwing troops at each other's trenches for 3 years.
Yeah. Got started and couldn't stop.
Yeah. You know, and so one of the things I don't really like about David Schroeder's rules here is that it doesn't really give you any, hey, by the way, what happens if Conrad would never have gone on the offensive against Italy, you know, and would have played it smart and just stayed on the defense and kept working with the Germans to take out Russia. You know, there's no really rule sets in here that give you some of those opportunities to explore those type of scenarios.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally understand. Ian, what do you think? We covered a lot of ground there.
I think find the games that you sort of build your own. I mean, I go back to the classic one that is that everyone points to is Paths of Glory. I'm surprised that, yeah, it actually, even though it does have the three different eras in it, the Mobilization, Limited War, Total War, the different sets of cards, it does give you a pretty good flexibility for doing, at least starting to explore the edges of some of those different cases. But a much more macro scale as Paths of Glory is. I think the interesting part of some of the game design is we've come out of the era of just hex and counter gaming. We've got people using different approaches to games and how they can take something and don't necessarily straitjacket you with the doctrine, but still force you to think in certain ways. I mean, I'm looking at even something as simple as Brave Little Belgium, which is really, it's just a race game. The Germans got to get from one side of the board to the other, and the Belgians are just trying to slow them down, and you have a little bit of a spoiler to the side, the British and the French, that can throw in a little bit of something. But, I mean, the Germans are going to get to the other side of the board. It's just a matter of how quick. And that's the whole game, just how quick. If you're the Germans, can you do it quickly? If you're the Belgium Allied player, how much can you slow them down? And I just think some of the newer game designs, some of the newer approaches don't lock you into the doctrinal, but they still deliver the experience, they still deliver the history and the flavor of the time in an interesting way.
One part of World War One that I think gets overlooked by a lot of folks, and Mike, we've talked about this some in the forums over the years, is a lot of folks really want to get fixated on the trench warfare in the West or the big army level maneuverings going on with the Russians, particularly given the political shenanigans going on behind the lines in Russia. But there were some pretty interesting battles being fought in the Balkans across a couple of different directions. Because you had the Austrians fighting the Serbians, you had the Romanians fighting the Bulgarians. I mean, the Serbians were kind of fighting everybody at some point or another. You had what was left of Italy sort of poking around along the coast where they could, as well as going up over the mountains towards the Austrians. But you had some very interesting multi-directional conflicts going on in the Balkans. You had the famous Lawrence of Arabia stuff going on out in the Middle East. You had General von Lettow-Vorbeck floating around East Africa, and you had some really weird colonial fights breaking out in the Pacific. And I think a lot of folks have sort of tentatively explored a couple of those different scenarios just for the sake of doing something different without necessarily really digging into the underlying differences in those battles. But I think once you get away from your normal East Front, West Front, you end up with some really interesting situations to sort of poke around in. The Germans in East Africa, I mean, that was a pretty significant guerrilla war for quite a while. And there are some definite parallels between the way the Germans behaved in that battle and in that campaign, not a single battle, and the way Washington did in the American War of Independence. It was sort of keep the army alive, moving around, pick your spots for some fights, but don't be afraid to leave, to retreat, to run away if it keeps the army intact. In the Balkans, you had sort of, I mean, you had a brawl. I mean, it really was very much a barroom brawl. It was lots of countries pushing and poking and prodding at each other in a variety of different ways. I mean, at some point, I think the Bulgarians were fighting five different countries at one time in World War One. And the Ottomans fighting on multiple fronts to include with themselves for a good chunk of it. I think there's some really interesting places you can go once you get away from the Americans, the Germans, the Russians. Mike, I know Der Weltkrieg explores some of these things, but pretty much just stays on the European continent. You poked around with some of those German East Africa games as well over the years, haven't you?
Not yet. I've got the one from Compass Games on pre-order. Schutztruppen. I know I probably totally boogered that up, but I do have that on pre-order. I haven't looked at it too closely at that area, but the Germans held out till the end of the war in Southeast Africa there. And I think I'd read somewhere where they kept over 300,000 British and colonial troops occupied. You know, 300,000 troops that didn't go and fight the Ottomans or go to the Western Front. So you're right. There's a lot more things going on. You know, Germany and Italy weren't officially at war until August of 1916, more than a year after Italy and Austria went to war.
Yeah, but it's the Italians. They really count?
Well,
I'm just being a smartass. You tend to look a little more at the naval side than either of us are going to. There were some naval fights around South America. There were some naval fights out in the Far East. Jutland's the famous one. What else is out there that gamers should have been paying attention to along the way?
Well, you've got the classic, the Battle of the Falklands, the World War One Battle of the Falklands, battle cruisers against each other. You have Coronel, where the British cruisers, the old British cruisers, get beaten up by the German battle cruisers. There's a, I think one of the underplayed yet very interesting pieces of the war, and there's been a couple games on them, is the whole idea of the cruiser warfare around the world. When the Germans started with ships and raiders all around the globe, and the British Empire trying to bring those in. There's some interesting little pieces that can come out of that. I did a war game scenario a long time ago for at one point a German raider pulled into early in the war. The German raider pulled into San Francisco, and the Canadians were out of position to try to intercept it. But the Germans pulled into San Francisco, did their 24 hours neutrality piece, you know, replenished and got out. And before the Canadians could come down, there was a Japanese ship in the area too. And if you take the Anglo-Japanese alliance, I mean, you can find little tiny pieces all around that could be really interesting. I mean, do a Japanese, Anglo-Japanese, Canadian, sort of scratch force taking on a German cruiser in San Francisco Bay or just outside San Francisco Bay. There's some interesting stuff, a lot of stuff across the Pacific. I think a lot of folks don't realize how much the Japanese picked up in the war, and the Japanese sending ships all the way to the Mediterranean, and taking some of those if things had really gone to the full measure, you know, have a World War I scenario of the Italian fleet versus the Austro-Hungarians versus the Japanese in World War I in the Mediterranean. There's a lot of fun things you could do.
Two thoughts crossed my mind when you were talking about the San Francisco thing, the Anglo-Japanese-Canadian force against it. First of all, it really sounds like you're making shit up. I know you're not.
I'll send you the reference later.
No. I know you're not, but it does. But the other thing is that almost sounds like a Shadowrun scenario more than World War I. You know, for anybody that's familiar with the Shadowrun RPG, that's what that sounds like. You know what I mean?
I mean, I think that gets to the point that there's a mythology about World War I. You were talking about it. Everything's East Front, West Front. And there actually is so much more out there, even if it's a small little battle and maybe, you know, nothing came of it. But eventually, you know, you can make something out of it. And maybe even have a fun, interesting game, or at least a good scenario for your game out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ian's kind of touched on some points there with you know, like the British, Canadian, Japanese naval alliance and stuff. And, you know, Brant, you were talking about how things ended in World War I that led to World War II and stuff. I'd read one time that at the Treaty of Versailles, the Japanese were pretty much put into a corner and ignored, you know, for what they wanted to gain at the end of the war. They felt they contributed quite a bit. And it's because they were ignored by the Europeans that they basically said, fine, we'll take matters into our own hands. And that's when you had them grabbing parts of Manchuria and kind of saying, we'll just do what we want to do. This is our own little corner of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all kinds of fallout. We're a little over an hour of recording time. Again, once I edit this down, we'll probably come down a little bit. So I wanted to throw something out that's not necessarily a wargame specific thing, but I want to toss an idea out there and get your guys' reactions to it, because 16, 17 years ago or so, I wrote a column for strategypage.com that really got a lot of people's hair standing on end. They really took offense at what I was saying, and I think a bunch of them just kind of missed my point. There was talk in the late 90s of the idea of this idea of a revolution in military affairs. And that the digitization of the battlefield was going to speed up our ability to share information so fast that we were going to see truly revolutionary ways in which we could engage in combat, and that the time lag from detection to you know, effects on target was going to shrink so fast that it was going to be almost unrecognizable to anybody else out there. Among other theses around this idea of a revolution in military affairs. And so I wrote this column, and it was at least in large part just to sort of put a provocative idea out there just to see what people would say. It was essentially World War I was our last true revolution in military affairs, because World War I was the first war in which we really fought in three dimensions. Up until World War I, It was land maneuver. It was sea maneuver. But you were fighting essentially on a flat plane. If you could get the high ground, that's fine. You get the high ground, but it's the high ground overlooking a flat plane. If you were, you weren't firing non-line of sight. If you were lobbing cannonballs at somebody, if you were lobbing artillery rounds at somebody, you might have had a spotter out there somewhere to tell you where the cannonballs landed inside the city walls, but you weren't putting accurate fire, non-line of sight anywhere. And if you happened to hit something, it was kind of unintentional, but you weren't showing up with the intent of aiming for and hitting specific targets beyond the line of sight from an artillery perspective. You didn't have aircraft engaging in combat. You had some spotting balloons out there, but you didn't have aerial combat. You weren't worried about overhead cover when you dug in as an infantryman because there wasn't anything coming from the sky. Naval warfare changed from being a flat two-dimensional thing on the ocean to now you've got three dimensions to worry about. You do have a nascent aircraft component that you have to worry about, but submarines became a real legitimate part of naval warfare in World War One, and that's where it really mattered. So World War One was a last true real revolution in military affairs because that moved warfare from two dimensions to three dimensions. That was the big argument that I made. And obviously, like, that pissed a lot of people off. But that was partly the intent, you know, was to get people really thinking about stuff. And so with that on the table to sort of, you know, poke holes in, Ian, how far off base was I? What do you think? What are your impressions of that idea?
I'm not sure if it was the last one. It definitely was a revolution in military affairs. I don't know if you could call it the first. I don't know if you could call it a last, but I think recognizing the war has the revolution in military affairs in so many different ways. That's a key to helping understand it. I'm not sure if I'd argue that, you know, by the whole concept that it's the last one, but it definitely was a major one. And I'll leave it at that for the moment.
Yeah. I wasn't arguing that it was the first. I was just arguing that it had been the most recent. So, Mike, what do you think?
I'm going to argue.
I think I'll disagree with Ian. I will agree with Ian on that point, you know.
Yeah, it wasn't one of those positions that I was going to, you know, it wasn't a hill I was going to die on. It was just me trying to sort of force some thought around the idea of the revolution of military affairs. In part, I was sick of hearing people talking about the revolution of military affairs, you know, it's, wait, how many of these have we really had? And so to sort of push back on some of that and see, that does lead to the question, though, of from a wargaming perspective, World War One was one of the first industrial level wars. Many of the wargames that we've got out there don't deal with things quite at the industrial scale where you're looking at, Mike, back to your original point, the start of the podcast, what's the food supply in Germany look like? You know, there was a big issue with munitions manufacturing in England early in the war in 1914, 1915. Churchill got appointed the Minister of Munitions at one point, didn't he? I may be completely misremembering that, but there was an issue with munitions manufacturing in England at one point in there. You had the challenge of getting some convoy supplies in and the Germans trying to blockade the British Isles. You had issues of gasoline because mechanized warfare was so new. How much gas do you actually have out there available to do things? And in over, you know, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you had issues of trying to keep all of the all the pack animals fed and supplied. For the size armies we are talking about, there's an enormous logistical requirement to maintain those things. How often do we see that show up in wargaming, that the industrial base actually matters in a big strategic level war game for World War One, similar to what you see with the economic engine behind something like Third Reich in a World War II war game? Ian, have you seen those things before? What, if any, examples do you have in mind?
No, I haven't. I mean, once again, maybe some of the cards in something like Paths of Glory get you somewhere close. But I think part of the reason we don't see that is because, you know, quite frankly, as much as you know, war planners would like to talk logistics. Logistics make pretty boring war games.
Oh God, yes.
we don't need another pasta rule for World War One. So it certainly is interesting and certainly can help create the conditions. But I think a lot of that is better served by designers being aware of it and then designers making some conscientious decisions in their design to expose part of it, let it have an influence on the game design, or to say, hey, I'm not going to deal with this and here's why, and we're going to focus on something else. At the end of the day, people want to play a war game for fun. And we aren't the professional, you know, war gamers out there trying to do policy decisions and that pieces of it. We're not that part of the crowd. We're the hobby recreational side. We want to have some fun and some, frankly, logistics, accepting that something like Holland Spiel's Supply Lines of the American Revolution, logistics is usually pretty boring and mundane.
Yeah. Yeah. As a guy who did it professionally for a while, yes, you are absolutely correct. There's not a lot of fun about it. It's supply Tetris.
It's important.
Yeah.
But not to a war gamer.
Yeah. Mike, Der Weltkrieg is sort of a primary reference point, but any others that you can think of that look at that industrial level manufacturing base and sort of not just manufacturing base, but kind of the national level supply effect at all?
No, in my sampling of strategic level World War One games isn't real deep, so
yeah,
I can't think of any right off the top of my head.
Yeah, the one that comes to mind that I can think of that I've actually played, not just observed or read about, the Ted Racer, look, of course, it was a Ted Racer game, right? But he about 15 years ago, his game called The First World War. The original one, I think, was published by Mayfair, was distributed in the U.S. by Mayfair, but was originally published by Phalanx Games. It looks kind of Paths of Glory-ish because it's got a variety of fronts with very linear movement up and down those fronts. You're moving large armies around with some dummy counters in there. And so there's a limited amount of maneuver sort of side to side in the battlefields once you're on the map. But there are a variety of sort of historical event chits that, quite frankly, these days, if you were designing that game today, those chits would be cards, not chits that you were drawing. But they do have a couple of different strategic effects on them, such as the munition shortage in England in 1915 or whatever it was. There are issues with the Austrian general staff and sort of political patronage and moving people in and out of certain positions for political machinations rather than competence on the battlefield. So there's a couple of different things like that that do play a factor in the game and can affect how much of what kind of action you can take depending on which player you are within the game. And so those things do pop up, but not in any real level of great detail such that you're going to get a lot of historical value out of them. They're there more for chrome than they are for any actual historical effect within the game. But again, my knowledge of World War One wargaming is PowerPoint deep is probably generous. So I'm not afraid to admit that as a blind spot for me.
You talked about the shortages from England. Russia had a lot of shortages up until about early part of 1916. You had artillery shell shortages. You had Russian troops showing up with no rifles, literally waiting for somebody else to get shot, killed, wounded,
yeah,
to get a rifle. You know, so they had a lot of problems, and so how do you build that into a game?
Yeah,
is a great question.
Yeah, same thing happened in World War II also, though. You know, so maybe steal some of the ideas from World War II.
Yeah,
maybe it's you've got some zero strength replacement counters behind the front that as those front level counters go down, you burn off one of those zero strength replacement counters to reconstitute the ones at the front. Again, I'm spitballing, right? But just throwing an idea out there. So.
But you bring up a good point, Grant. There's the game designs come a long way, and there's a lot of different ways you can do it. Ted Racer originally did chits, then he went to cards. There's a lot of different, I think, World War One is a war that's ripe for designers to take a look at and see what they can do, because you can do a lot more, especially if you break out of the classic hex encounter approach to a war game. And you can get a lot more depth into there without a lot more rules overhead. I mean, Paths of Glory itself is a great example of how you take a game that was, you know, classically seen as attrition. And yes, you end up with trenches in Paths of Glory. That's one possibility. But there's still so much more going on because of it, that the game really does feel more. Every time I've played Paths of Glory, yes, you end up with the trenches, but you don't feel that you're, and yes, you get the attrition there, but you always feel that you've got something else going on because you're looking at those other fronts. It forces you to look beyond the myth of the East and West and look at some of the peripheral theaters and what can you do, and how do I bring in extra forces? How do I take that industrial, be it through ops cards or something of the like, to bring some more power to bear, that to break out of the trenches and get moving. There's a lot of ripe territory for game designs, especially if they take a non-traditional approach to it.
Yeah, and I think maybe even more than World War II, World War I gives you some really good options for multiplayer, multipolar play. Especially once you get away from the Brits and the French fighting the Germans on the Western Front, that once you get away from that a little bit, there's a variety of pretty good options to, you know, over in the Balkans. As a, for instance, you mentioned a couple of the different, you know, wacky combinations you had sort of floating around out in the Pacific. But there's a couple of different pretty interesting combinations that you can put together. I really think the Balkans as like a 7-player game, you still might not get all of the options available, you know, all the different combinations available to you, even trying to do it that way in the Balkans. I just think there's a lot of really good pieces out there. There was a computer game 5-6 years ago, Making History, The Great War, the guys over at Muzzy Lane, that had, it was intended as an educational game. It was not intended purely as a hobby war game, but it was the hobby war gamers that sort of gravitated to it because they were the ones that kind of got it with the interface. It was a very Europa Universalis kind of interface in which you could play damn near every country. And quite frankly, you literally could play every country. You could play the Emirate of Jabal Shamar as one of the playable countries as a minor nation in all of this. It almost went to an insane level of detail that went way beyond what was necessary for educational purposes, but it gave you that level of granularity. It gave you the option to explore lots of different crazy combinations within the game. You know, it was a digital game, so it's a little different than where we've been talking hex encounter stuff up until now, or tabletop stuff up until now. But maybe that's a new place that folks can go, is to, you know, diplomacy famously is the lead up to World War One. Maybe we need diplomacy to continue with World War One actually going on the map and see what happens. And who knows? We're to the point now where we need to kind of get some parting shots in. Ian, we'll let you go first. What do you think? Kind of wrapping up some of this World War One discussion here.
I think the World War One was full of a lot of myths, and many war games lean into those myths. But if you take a risk on some of the different designers and explore the edges of some of those myths, you find out that it really was a very dynamic war. There was a lot going on, and there's a lot of space to experiment with war games and play. If you just look beyond, you got to look beyond the myth. And I think they're out there. You just got to look and find them, and you'll enjoy them.
Yeah. Mike, last shot's yours.
To me, I agree with everything that Ian said. I'll go back to the beginning of the discussion too, where you asked me why I'm interested in it. To me, it just changed so much of Europe at the time. And it did lead to World War II, not because of the Treaty of Versailles, but just because of everything else that happened. I mean, at the end of the war, you had four empires that came to an end. You had the Russian, the German, the Austrian-Hungary, and the Ottoman empires all came to an end. And you had a lot of countries that were born out of those ruins. You had Czechoslovakia, you had Hungary, you had Yugoslavia, Finland, the Baltic states, Poland, all came out of those empires, along with all the pieces that, that came out of the Ottoman Empire. It's just something that gets glossed over in the history books in high school, I think. And yet there was so much to it that, that still has ripple effects today.
Yeah, I think one of the things World War One definitely marks the end of was sort of that, that monarchical era of national government, the idea of those government, the nations as being imbued in the ruling family more than they are a nation of people, the Austro-Hungarian Empire being a key one that, that sort of fell apart there, that, that you got these nations show up that were not, that were almost a little artificial. You know, you mentioned both Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, neither of which exist now. So, you know, maybe it wasn't the best idea, but, right. But yeah, those effects definitely, again, rippled all the way into the 90s and the 2000s, even today, that, that we're still seeing some of those effects that, 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 you know, laws of unintended consequences there. Guys, it's been fun. I appreciate y'all joining us here on Mention and Dispatches for what we hope for the audience was an interesting podcast. We didn't always stick real close to the wargaming path necessarily, but I think the I think it was some good discussion on the topic. And so I appreciate you guys taking the time to do this. And we appreciate the audience taking the time to join us on this trench-filled slog through World War One. It's just a myth. It wasn't a slog. It's okay. Ian, thank you very much. Appreciate you being here.
Awesome. Thank you very much. I hope everyone has a good night.
And Mike, thank you also for taking the time and then reacting at the last moment to the fact that you'd been invited to this a month ago. So appreciate you being able to clear calendar.
It was fun.
And audience, never fear. We still have cool things coming up for you later this season. The Musketeers coming back. We're going to talk some horse and musket coming up down the way. We're going to talk some monster game stuff, some OCS things, and other big games with folks. We're, for the first time on Mention and Dispatches, we're going to outer space. We're going to talk a little space combat with, believe it or not, a space combat expert, among some other folks. The Compass Games catalog arrived in my mail today. So, you know, at some point over the next couple of weeks, we're going to talk about the Compass Games catalog because we just can't help ourselves. It's really cool and we always enjoy going through it. So, audience, thank you very much for joining us and we'll catch you next time.